The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of the Honourable Simon Bridges.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by all her government's statements, policies and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, following the three-week recess, yes.
In light of the median rent increasing by $50 under her watch, does she now agree with the advice of her officials that her government's policies, such as higher taxes and regulations on landlords, would drive up rents?
Mr. Speaker, no.
Why has her government legislated for 23.5 cents of petrol tax increases in Auckland and 12 cents of petrol tax increases across the rest of New Zealand, while at the same time stalling, postponing or cancelling 12 major roading projects?
Mr. Speaker, the member will be talking about the unfunded roading projects that he had as a government. And of course, our policy on excise was not too dissimilar to the last government. Excise is what allows us to make record investment into regional roads, road safety initiatives and public transport to try and deal with the congestion that you'll see many Aucklanders are complaining about because there's been a lack of decent infrastructure investment.
Does she accept there are more New Zealand families struggling to keep up with the cost of living since she became Prime Minister?
Mr. Speaker, actually, I'll fall back on what some of the numbers tell us. Under National's first term, wages rose around 2.1% a year. Under our first term, wages are projected to rise to 3.2%. And also add to that the increase in minimum wage that we've made up to $17.70 an hour. Add to that the changes to the family tax credit, the changes with the winter energy payment, the Best Start payment, paid parental leave that on average mean that families are $75 a week better off for over 380,000 families. We absolutely acknowledge cost of pressure issues, which is why we've targeted low and middle income families, and we've also done things through education to, for instance, remove NCEA fees, school donations for decile 7 and below, and make it cheaper to go to the doctor.
In light of her numbers, does she accept the number of hardship grants are up 71% since she became Prime Minister?
Mr. Speaker, I absolutely acknowledge those numbers, and what we won't do, unlike the last government, is do anything to try and hide that. In fact, one of the statements we made when we first came in was that we absolutely believed we weren't seeing the actual need. And so we made a very public statement that those in need should come forward, and we made a very clear instruction to Work and Income, meet the need that you see, and that is exactly what the numbers are demonstrating.
Isn't the real reason those hardship grants are up 71%? Because under her government's policies, cost of living such as rent and petrol have increased, and the economy is sharply weakening, meaning there are more people without jobs.
Mr. Speaker, no.
Does she agree with Andrew Little, who in 2017, after a 14% rise in hardship grants, said it's, quote, a sad commentary for the government's handling of the economy and how it prioritises the well-being of the poorest in New Zealand. Kiwis are doing it tougher and this government has no plan to help.
Oh, Mr. Speaker, there was no plan to help them.
Well, if she agrees, does she think her government is much more deserving of criticism, given hardship grants haven't increased 14%, but 71% in just 20 or so months under her watch?
Mr. Speaker, no.
How many more people are on the dole now compared to this time last year?
Mr. Speaker, when you look at the proportion of people on a benefit relative to the working age population, from memory it's around 9.7%. It was up over 10% 5 years ago, so we're still lower than we were under the last speaker, the last member being in office.
Order. I'm going to remind the Deputy Leader of the Opposition of Speaker's ruling 1747 and tell her that she's not responsible for ensuring proper answers.
Why are there 14,000 more people on the dole now than this time last year?
Mr. Speaker, I could ask the member why there were more under his government as well. Again, I can also tell the member that one of the reasons, of course, is we believe that there hasn't been the investment in case management, the kind of support that supports people into work. We've invested in more than 200 case managers to support individual applicants into work. We've also, Mr. Speaker, I have to say, acknowledged that MSD's seen over 17,000 people in that period go into work as well. In order to make sure we're comparing apples and apples, it's always important to measure against the number of people who are available for work. And on that measure, Mr. Speaker, as I've already said, there are still fewer people on main benefits than there were 5 years ago under the National Government.
Question number two, Jenny Marcroft.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Regional Economic Development. It asks, what recent Provincial Growth Fund announcements has he made?
Honourable Shane Jones.
Mr. Speaker, over the past 3 weeks, from Fovo Strait to Kaitaia, the First Citizen of the provinces has been active. Each region serves different. Each requires a particular mix of policy and intervention to boost productivity. But the announcements have covered manufacturing, tourism, forestry, mineral extraction, roading, horticulture, and, for the edification of the opposition, biogas.
Supplementary. What are some specific projects that were supported?
Sir, the Invercargill Airport, air cargo, a neglected part of New Zealand over the last 9 years. Terminal development, we have turned it around, sir, so that terminal only applies to the physical infrastructure, not the aspirations of that region, as they've been saddled with over the last 9 years. $500,000 to upgrade the first direct jet connection between Auckland and Invercargill. And one other, sir, just to show that we have our eye on the more forgotten parts of New Zealand, the $1 billion tree investment of $5 million to address a promise made by the former Treaty Minister to that tribe to deal with the Waiapu catchment challenges, showing that we fly high and we also deal with things on the ground.
What progress did he observe on some PGF projects already underway?
Order. The member will resume his seat. There's a very fundamental requirement for supplementary questions, and that is that they have to relate to the primary question, and that one didn't. Right. Question number three, the Honourable Simon Bridges.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister. Does she stand by all her government's statements, policies and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Does she agree with the Automobile Association Auckland Congestion Report that, quote, action is urgently needed beyond what's planned in the current project, end quote, and there are, quote, serious question marks around whether the Auckland Transport Project Program can deliver predicted decongestion outcomes?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, look, we absolutely acknowledge that we have a congestion issue in Auckland. That is due to a significant level of underinvestment. It took 5 years, for instance, for the last government to decide that the CRL was a necessary piece of infrastructure, which will take tens of thousands of Aucklanders off the road and is a would represent the equivalent of quite a significant piece of motorway investment. Mr. Speaker, we are having to play catch-up.
How can she say that when in the last small number of weeks Phil Twyford himself has said that the former National Government, quote, significantly overinvested in roading around Auckland?
Mr. Speaker, I was obviously talking about our transport infrastructure, including public transport, which obviously the member didn't invest in.
Why has the government cancelled investment in Auckland projects such as the East-West Link, Mill Road and Warkworth to Wellsford?
Mr. Speaker, as the member of Minister of Transport is indicating, that's not an entirely accurate statement, but also we have, of course, applied a decent cost-benefit analysis for some of those projects as well, something that we long encouraged the last government to do. Mr. Speaker, if we're going to be talking, though, about transport, Mr. Speaker, I would be very encouraged to hear whether or not any of the members' plans around transport investment also factor in our obligations under the Paris Agreement that he signed us up to, because he seems quite fixated on roads rather than public transport or, for instance, fuel-efficient vehicles, which I'd be happy to debate with him.
He then be explicit and make clear to this House that the government's unstated policy is that roads are bad for climate change.
No, no, Mr. Speaker.
What transport projects has her government started to replace the many roading projects that they cancelled of Nationals?
Mr. Speaker, I think you used the word cancelled loosely. They were ghost roads and they were not funded.
What transport projects has your government started?
Mr. Speaker, of course, we are well underway with the planning around rail to the airport, which is something that member never did.
When will construction start on that project?
Mr. Speaker, if the member wants specific details of our projects, then I'll ask the Minister of Transport. But again, if the member now is telling me that his last 10 years that he holds no responsibility for those currently sitting in congestion in Auckland when he was the minister, then, Mr. Speaker, I find that laughable.
In light of your...
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Oh, here comes...
Can the Prime Minister...
Order.
Can the Prime Minister confirm that the supposed cancelled roads the Leader of the Opposition mentions in his question amounted to $12 billion worth of roading projects, none of which were budgeted for?
Mr. Speaker, absolutely. And I also have to say that I don't know how he would pay for it, given he stands opposed to excise tax as well. So not only was he promoting ghost roads, he had no plans to fund them. In fact, the Ministry of Transport, if my recollection is clear, said that he would need to introduce an 8 cent per litre excise tax to pay for his ghost roads.
The Honourable Simon Bridges.
In light of her talk of planning of light rail to the airport and also benefit cost ratios, what, given all that planning on that project, is the benefit cost ratio of light rail to the airport?
Mr. Speaker, look, if the member wants to put a question on notice, I would be happy to duel over whether or not we should have light rail to the airport. But, Mr. Speaker, I think if you canvass Aucklanders about whether or not there is enough investment in public transport, the resounding answer would be no. If we want an international city, if we want to increase productivity, we need to invest in projects like the City Rail Link, which the member was very slow to come to the party on, and rail to the airport.
The Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Could the Prime Minister tell the country how many dollars were set aside by the previous Minister of Transport for the Whangarei to work with much-vaunted superhighway?
Mr. Speaker, I don't believe there was any.
No.
Isn't the reality of that the Transport Agency had done all the planning required effectively for a Whangarei North Port, but the Transport Minister cancelled that $450 million project at the start of 2018?
Mr. Speaker, a plan is very different to actually having funded the road, and I note that many, many National Party members around the country are putting up billboards about ghost roads which never, ever, ever had the funding to deliver.
Does she agree with the Road to Zero discussion document Julianne Jenter launched last week, which states that 87% of New Zealand roads have speed limits presently set too high?
Speaker, actually, if the member takes the time to talk to some of the local councils, he'll find that there are mayors up and down the country where there are areas of road where they feel that their local populations are not being well served. We're not going to see large-scale speed limit reductions, but we are going to listen to people locally who raise issues around particular spots where people have lost their lives.
The Honourable Julianne Jenter.
Can she confirm that Identifying areas where roads need to be engineered up is just as important in identifying where speed limits are inappropriate as it is to identify places where speeds might drop in some places. And the government has no plan to drop speed limits on wide swathes of New Zealand's network, but to make it safer. Mr. Speaker, well,
the Prime Minister may answer one of those five questions.
I can confirm that, and that is why, of course, as part of our transport investment, we are looking at investing $1.4 billion over the next 3 years in targeted road safety upgrades. By 2021, we plan to upgrade 3,300 kilometres of high-risk highway. And, of course, that is through upgrade work rather than speed limit changes.
Is the sum total of the government's work in transport to date to stop Nationals projects, not starting new ones, and slow New Zealand down?
Mr. Speaker, no.
Question number four, Kiritapuena.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant
Robertson. Mr. Speaker, last week's BNZ Business New Zealand Performance of Services Index showed New Zealand's services sector continues to grow and expand in the month of June. While its expansion was slightly slower than in May, it is important to note that our services sector, particularly relating to tourism and trade, is connected to the global economy. The uncertain economic backdrop and slowing global growth will have an impact on this sector. But, Mr. Speaker, it is encouraging to see that New Zealand's expansionary services index of 52.7 for June was higher than in Australia, the UK, China, Japan and the United States, demonstrating the continued strong performance of the New Zealand economy compared with our peers.
Supplementary, sir. What reports has he seen on the manufacturing sector?
Oh, Mr. Speaker, the recess also saw the release of the BNZ Business New Zealand Performance of Manufacturing Index, showing the manufacturing sector expanded faster in June than in May. The June PMI reading of 51.3 was up from 15.4 in May. This stands in contrast to manufacturing sectors in other countries which contracted in June, that being in Australia, the UK, Japan, China and the Eurozone. And even while the United States expanded at 50.6%, it was lower than New Zealand's reading. Mr. Speaker, this data represents more evidence that the New Zealand economy continues to grow solidly and outperform our international peers.
Supplementary, sir. What reports has he seen on inflation?
Well, Mr. Speaker, last week Stats New Zealand released CPI data for the June quarter, showing inflation of 0.6% in the quarter and 1.7% annually, in line with the Treasury's forecast. This compares favourably with the latest data showing hourly wage growth of 3.4% in the March quarter and Treasury's forecast showing wage growth around this level over the forecast period. Mr. Speaker, this is good news for New Zealand households and workers at a time when the economy is growing solidly compared to the rest of the world, and unemployment is at record lows. The government is keeping the cost of living under control on this measure.
Question number five, the Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance and asks, are the government's economic policies delivering a stable and growing economy which is fair to all New Zealanders?
Mr. Speaker.
Mr.
Speaker, yes, after 9 years of the government failing to deliver an economy that is fair for all New Zealanders, over the last 20 months we are making good progress on turning that around.
Supplementary, does he think a 70% increase in hardship grants under this government to almost 500,000 is a sign of an economy that is fair to all New Zealanders?
Well, Mr. Speaker, one of the things that the Prime Minister has already mentioned is that we, as a government over here, are not hiding away figures like that. We've actually encouraged staff within work and income to give people what they are entitled to while we turn around the economy to deliver the jobs that they so desperately want.
So is it a sign that things are getting better under this government or worse?
Well, Mr. Speaker, there are many, many signs that things are getting better under this government, and I include in that, Mr. Speaker, the fact that I'm happy to purchase for the member a pair of cufflinks.
Mr. Speaker, has his Cabinet colleague Andrew Little told him that the 70% increase in hardship grants is a damning indictment on their government?
Mr Speaker, I think the Leader of the Opposition must have handed Mr Goldsmith his notes, since he's now repeating all of his questions. What I would say to that member is, on this side of the House, if we get to the end of Mr Little's quote, which we heard before, is that we actually have a plan to make this economy not only stronger but fairer, unlike the last government.
He is aware that Mr Little, Andrew Little, thought a 14% increase under National was an indictment. How does he now accept that judgment against his government, now that it's much, much worse?
Mr Speaker, no. What I do think is that on this side of the House, we have actually got a plan to build an economy that's fairer for New Zealand. So when we lift the minimum wage to $17.70 an hour and that party opposes us, does that make it fair? When on this side of the House we index main benefits to the average wage and that side of the House oppose it, we know what's fair on this side of the House.
Question number six, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Housing and Urban Development, is she confident that the implementation of the Kiwi Build Buying Off the Plans program has been consistent with Cabinet decisions?
Just for future reference, the name of the Minister has changed. The Honourable Dr Megan Woods.
Yes, I'm advised every buying off the plans deal has met the requirements of the business case as assessed by Treasury as per Cabinet requirements. I do note that although the members' concerns expressed to the Auditor-General have not resulted in a specific inquiry, the Auditor-General has passed the members' complaint to the appropriate agency, Audit New Zealand, which has been conducting a regular audit of the Ministry of Housing and Urban Development since before the member made her complaint.
How does the government define what are, quote, new homes off the plan, end quote?
Please repeat the question.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. How does the government define what are, quote, new homes off the plan, end quote?
Mr Speaker, this differs from deal to deal, but the main point of how it is, the primary objective, is to increase the supply of dwellings at affordable price points for every time entry-level buyers. So one of the main objectives strategically, Mr Speaker, is to free up the market so that more developments can proceed.
How can 10 apartments in Otahuhu be considered to be in a planning stage when they were already built, already had a code of compliance certificate and had already been unsuccessfully marketed prior to being signed up for a buying off the plans initiative?
Mr Speaker, some of the homes were already under construction or built, but what this has done is enabled developers to move on more rapidly to building other homes. For instance, Shane Brearley of New Zealand Living said the outright purchase of homes at Mason Square and the underwrite at 340 Onehunga allowed him to get building at least 6 months earlier at 340 Onehunga and start his development in Northcote, which he said would have been just a twinkle in his eye without Kiwi Build. And Mr Speaker, I note that in only a few days, 102 apartments, 72 of which will be Kiwi Build at Northcote, will be available. This is the impact that this scheme can have.
Point of order. Mr Speaker, I asked about apartments in Otahuhu, not about Onehunga or Northcote.
I'll let the member have another crack at it. The Minister.
Mr Speaker, I think the member must have missed the point in my answer when I said that actually what the deal that was done at Otahuhu was allowed the Onehunga and the Northcote developments to proceed.
So is she aware that Kiwi Build houses in Canterbury, Huapai and Otahuhu now do not qualify as new houses under the government's Home Start grant because the codes of compliance certificates for these houses were issued by the council more than 6 months before they were able to be purchased by Kiwi Build buyers?
Mr. Speaker, in the course of resetting KiwiBuild, there will be a number of very practical and pragmatic issues that I'll be looking at. That, along with the fact that banks give a 3-month pre-approval rating to new home buyers, which makes it very hard for a new home buyer to buy a new property off the plans. More than happy to look at these kind of things. We on this side of the House are not afraid to admit that this is difficult. That member should know that her government made a commitment to deliver 39,000 houses over 3 years under the special housing area. They delivered 3,157, 100 of which were affordable. We don't pretend this is easy.
Point of order.
A point of order, the Honourable Judith
Cummins. Oh, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I seek leave to table some documents. The first is a KiwiBuild pipeline showing the Otahu properties were contracted for KiWiBuild on the 2nd of November. This is from an Official Information Act request that I've received some information back on from the Minister's office.
Well, yes. We'll do them one at a time. Is there any objection to that being tabled? There appears to be none.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to table a letter from the Auckland Council confirming completion of the Otahu properties dated the 6th of September 2018.
Is there any objection to that being tabled? There appears to be none. Further supplementary, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Another point of order, Mr. Speaker.
Another point of order, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to table a code of compliance certificate confirming that the Otahu properties were consented on the 20th of September 2017, before the last election.
And your member's going to confirm that that is not available on the web?
Mr. Speaker, I couldn't tell you if it's available on the web, but it's certainly been received from Auckland Council.
Most likely not on the web.
Is there any objection to that being tabled? There appears to be none. Further supplementary? Question number 7, Dr. Liz Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health and asks, what progress, if any, is being made on the design and development of new frontline mental health and addiction services?
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, the wellbeing budget included an investment of $455 million to create new frontline services for people with mild to moderate mental health and addiction needs. These free services must be easy to access, easy to navigate, and they must work for the people that need them. To make sure that they do just that, we need to listen to those with lived experience and those who work in the sector. We took an important step in that process today with the first of 5 Ministry of Health workshops with mental health and addiction leaders, NGOs and community organisations.
Supplementary. So how will the government ensure that these new frontline services meet the needs of different communities?
Mr. Speaker, one of the clear messages out of the inquiry into mental health and addiction was the importance of working with communities when developing these services. We can't assume that a service designed in Wellington will necessarily work in the far north or rural Canterbury. We need a range of services, kaupapa Māori services, youth services, Pacific people services, and programs for rural communities. The best way to design those services is alongside those communities, and that's why today's workshop and the 4 others around the country are so important.
Supplementary. So how long will it take to develop these services?
Mr. Speaker, transforming our approach to mental health and addiction will take time. We know we need more trained mental health workers and peer support people, and have invested $80.1 million in workforce development over the next 4 years. It's a pretty desperate interjection from the Leader of the Opposition. The new frontline service is being rolled out over 5 years, but they are already...
Order. Member, resume the seat. I just... I'm going to ask the Minister to focus on his answer and not be diverted by the quality of interjections.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The new frontline service is being rolled out over 5 years, but there are already services that are doing good work and can be expanded in relatively short order. I expect to have further announcements about this in coming months.
Question number 8, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. Does he stand by his statement that national health targets created, quote, perverse incentives, end quote?
The Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, the previous government's narrow set of targets produced perverse incentives and resulted in what were traditionally cheaper surgeries being performed in more expensive environments. I do not want the numbers pumped up by counting Avastin injections and skin lesion removals that could have been done in primary care as surgeries only if they're done in the most expensive environment possible. The answer to the member's question is yes.
Could the experience of Winton farmer Blair Vining, who was told he would wait 8 weeks from his cancer diagnosis for his first appointment, and then spent 13 hours in Christchurch Hospital's emergency department, be described as perverse?
Mr. Speaker, I think the care Mr. Vining has received has fallen short, and I have made that clear.
Is the dramatic drop in childhood immunisation rates to as low as 61% for Māori babies an example of a perverse outcome?
Mr. Speaker, our immunisation rate for children have been hovering just above 90% for a long time, and it's proved difficult to reach that last few percent of the population. I know that our clinicians and public health staff understand full well the importance of immunisation and are working hard to ensure that more people benefit from the protection offered by immunisation. Unfortunately, that target set by the previous government has never been achieved, and it's incredibly important that people do get immunised and appreciate the importance not only to protecting themselves from potentially deadly diseases like the measles, but also to protect their loved ones, elderly, children and other vulnerable members of society. So I encourage all who are able and fit to please get immunised.
Does he expect the final figure for elective surgery, excluding Avastin injections and skin lesion treatments, in 2018-19 to be higher or lower than the previous year?
Mr. Speaker, the important point here is that electives are not the only form of planned care. And I would remind the member again that we are seeing more acute surgery and more non-admitted procedures completed, which means more people are getting care that they need in the most appropriate, cost-effective and convenient setting. I have been advised that as at the end of May, DHBs were reported to be at 99.4% of planned levels.
That will include Avastin. Isn't it a case, though, that de-emphasising the very targets that are so important to New Zealanders has resulted in those important health outputs going backwards on his watch?
Mr. Speaker, no.
Question number 9, the Honourable Louise Upston.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and asks, why are there 15,507 more people on the JobSeeker support benefit than there were in September 2017?
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
Mr. Speaker, the recent increase is primarily driven by population growth and a reduction in growth for some industries where historically MSD clients have often gone into. We have very low levels of unemployment, and in a tight labour market, employers want skilled workers. That's why we're focused on training and upskilling people on benefit. For those that may need help, MSD is committed to giving them support both financially and through assistance into appropriate upskilling and employment so they can achieve the best long-term outcomes for them and their whānau.
Supplementary. Why has there been a 17% increase of people aged 18 to 24 on the JobSeeker benefit in the last year?
Mr. Speaker, putting it into context, there's also been a reduction of young people coming in on the youth payment. What we need to put in perspective here is that young people are as affected as others, and so therefore a population growth is a factor and the softening in some particular industries is a factor, then that of course is going to have an impact on their employment rate as well.
Supplementary. Why are there 710 people in Tauranga who've been on a JobSeeker benefit for more than 12 months when there are 841 jobs currently advertised on Trade Me?
Mr. Speaker, many of the jobs being promoted are requiring upskilled people. And Mr. Speaker, that is why we as a government are focused on upskilling and training. It's unfortunate that there wasn't as much of a focus under the previous government, otherwise we wouldn't have been in this situation.
Programs like Mana and Mahi that are targeted towards young people, that will support them into employment opportunities that are meaningful for them, will provide them with the opportunities that they need to go into employment.
Supplementary. Does she agree that there's a clear link between the increase in job seeker beneficiaries and the decrease in sanctions her government has applied for unfulfilled work obligations?
Mr Speaker, I've been advised that there is no link, that the two reasons that I gave at the beginning are the primary reasons with regards to the fact that population growth is a factor, and also the softening in some areas where our people would have traditionally gone into. Mr Speaker, we are focused on upskilling and training people who come through the welfare system and making sure that they are matched up with meaningful and sustainable job opportunities for them. Mr Speaker, we don't want to see the churn of people going off and then back on benefit that was experienced under the previous government.
When is she changing the name of the job seeker benefit if her government isn't requiring people to turn up for interviews?
Mr Speaker, we are working hard with New Zealanders who come through the welfare system. It is disappointing that under the previous government there was a diminishing amount of support for people who were unemployed to be able to take up work opportunities. In fact, at the last budget, New Zealand would be aware that we invested so that we have 263 more frontline staff focused on work so that we can support New Zealanders into employment. And that's alongside other initiatives like the Oranga Mahi program, where we've injected an additional $26 million to particularly support disabled people into employment. And I want to make a note of that, given that we know that 53% of those that are in the welfare system either have a health condition or a disability of some sort, or are caring for a person with a health condition or disability of some sort. We want to support them into employment, and that's what this government's doing.
Question number 10, Greg O'Connor.
Mr Speaker, will the proposed Minister of Police, will the proposed changes to the Arms Act 1983 improve public safety in New Zealand? If so, how?
The Honourable Stuart Nash.
Mr Speaker, our gun laws date from 1983 and are dangerously out of date. Since then, the firearms industry, the marketplace and the threat environment has changed considerably. Successive governments have known since the Thorpe Review of 1997 that our gun laws were too weak. Further attempts to change the system in 2005 and 2016 both failed. A firearms register, tighter licensing system for gun owners, and a new emphasis on safety and personal responsibility is the focus of upcoming legislation that we announced yesterday. In April, we acted to take the most dangerous weapons out of circulation by prohibiting assault rifles and military-style semi-automatics. We are now moving to stop other firearms falling into the wrong hands.
Supplementary, Mr Speaker, why will the firearms register help keep New Zealanders safe?
Mr Speaker, the majority of firearms licence holders are law-abiding citizens, and we have seen this through the initial stages of the buyback scheme and amnesty. Based on the experience in some Australian states, we expect the registry will make it more difficult for firearms to fall into the hands of people who intend using them to cause significant harm. The ability to track possession of a firearm over time will provide police with information to better manage the risks to personal and public safety from firearms. We know that firearms are increasingly being used in the commission of violent offences, and increasing numbers are being seized by police. For example, 950 firearms have been seized since March this year. Police in their line of duty also have to face firearms every day. And as the Police Association has stated, and I quote, a register will also provide valuable intelligence on the number of firearms registered to an address. And this should help police officers turning up to volatile family harm instances, which account for a huge percentage of an officer's daily work, end quote.
Further supplementary, Mr Speaker, what reports has he seen in favour of the government's reforms?
Mr Speaker, these changes have been decades in the making, and I have seen numerous reports in favour of the changes. But, Mr. Speaker, if there is one report I would like to share with the House today, it is a letter I received from an individual in Waipakurau who wrote to me on the 15th of July about Constable Len Snee, who was fatally shot 10 years ago in Napier. And I quote, "I'm an old school friend of the late Constable Len Snee. We're at Takapau Primary School. With that, I would like to see a gun register of weapons and their owners as we had back then in our school days. Len might still be here if we had the old register going." End quote. As the Minister of Police, it is my responsibility to ensure that police have the resources to keep our communities safe and be able to go home to their families after their shift. We as a House need to work together to make changes to our outdated firearms laws. We owe it to Constable Len Snee, the 51 people in Christchurch and their families and friends to ensure that we do all that we can to find the right balance.
Question number 11, Brett Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Police and asks, does he stand by all the government's statements, policies and actions in relation to firearm law reform?
Mr. Speaker, yes, apart from a mistaken comment when I said you need to be a New Zealand citizen to apply for a firearms licence under the proposed law. You don't. But, Mr. Speaker, I will be interested in hearing public submissions on the topic.
Supplementary, thank you, Mr. Speaker. What specific changes announced yesterday target illegal firearm use by gangs and violent offenders?
Mr. Speaker, the aim of this legislation is to make it a lot more difficult for guns to fall into the hands of those who would use them to create harm.
Supplementary, will being gang affiliated be a warning flag the police take into account to intervene if they have concerns about a licence holder's behaviour?
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Supplementary, why is the government rushing to impose more costs and red tape on law-abiding firearms owners, yet doing more consultation on stopping violent gang members using guns?
Mr. Speaker, these changes should not come as a surprise. The Arms Act has not seen substantial reform in the last 36 years and it is no longer fit for purpose. The changes proposed will establish a system that strikes a better balance with the safe use of firearms and the need to manage the risk to personal and public safety. We want to make it harder for firearms to fall into the wrong hands. Mr. Speaker, the changes establish that possessing a firearm is a privilege and not a right, and will better reflect the harm that firearms can cause.
Question number 12, David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Police and reads as follows. Would the proposed changes to gun laws announced yesterday have prevented the Christchurch terror attacks? If so, how?
Mr. Speaker, we could not turn back time, but we can act to lessen the risk of similar events happening again. We've already moved to remove the most dangerous weapons from our communities. We are now moving to lessen the risk of other firearms falling into the wrong hands.
Supplementary. Does the Minister acknowledge the answer he just gave did not in any way directly answer the primary question?
Mr. Speaker, as I said, we can't turn back time. What I will say is the Royal Commission will examine events leading up to the attack and I will not preempt its work, but what I will also say is it's public knowledge that we are introducing flags around warning behaviour. For example, encouraging or promoting extreme or violent behaviour would be a warning flag, and a register would allow us to track the accumulation of large volumes of weapons and ammunition over a short period of time as occurred prior to the Christchurch attack.
Does the Minister agree that this legislation, again with a shortened public consultation, is not about public safety, but is about providing a distraction for a government that is failing in every other area of policy?
Order. That A point of order, David Seymour.
Mr. Speaker, I asked the question. Normally they answer.
Yes, and I didn't call the Minister to answer it because it was out of order.
Well, I don't understand why, Mr.
Well,
Speaker.
I'm not going to be responsible for the members' failure to understand.
Well, Mr. Speaker, you could help by explaining for the public watching why that question is not in order.
And the member might, in fact, like to look at Speaker's rulings and standing orders and understand it for himself, so he doesn't make errors like that in the future.
That concludes oral questions.